Show your T-ball team spirit and buy your hard-working Art Lab team a cup of coffee, which helps fuel purchases of high-octane equipment and T-ball tech that get poured back into percolating, highly caffeinated content for you. Just go to buymeacoffee.com and search Therapy Bites.
On this episode of Therapy Bites Art Lab.
Everyone, welcome Matt Whitten. His thriller killer story coming out from Ocean View Publishing on January the 17th, 2023, is about an idealistic journalist who launches a true crime podcast to investigate the murder of an alt-right YouTuber she loved like a little sister, despite their political differences. Matt Whitten is a TV writer and novelist who has written for House, Pretty Little Liars, Law and Order, and CSI Miami, along with several other shows. His six novels include The Necklace, which came out on Ocean View Publishing last year and has been optioned for film by none other than that Titanic guy, Leonardo DiCaprio. Matt has won the Malice Domestic Award, that sounds kind of scary, and has been nominated for two Edgars and an Emmy. His latest novel is Killer Story, which is set in the world of true crime podcasting. He's currently writing a pilot for NBC, and he's here with us in the Art Lab today for an episode called Killer Stories, The Psychology of Psychopathy. How do you bring a murderer to life? What's different about the psychopath that may be living next door to you? How do you bring a story to life and hang on to your sanity? How do you survive a psychopath should you ever run into one? And do you have to be a psychopath to actually write about a psychopath? Everyone, welcome Matt Whitten. Matt, thanks for being on the show today.
Stay tuned following the interview for On the Couch and Off the Rocker, our special guest's psychocilly analysis by Art Lab's own head cabbager, Dr. Ima Freudknot.
Welcome to Therapy Bites Art Lab, where Dr. Heath and his special guests share real-life stories of helping and healing. Fresh from the actual therapy couch, while taking a bite out of common counseling missteps and misconceptions. And now, here's Heath and the T-Ball team.
And hey, Matt, welcome to the show. First off, and this is why we're having this video in person, and this is giving your writing background of your current book, not to put you on the spot, but have you ever killed anybody? Because you're writing about killers. I'm just interested in your personal experience.
Not yet. Although I once did teach a course in prison. And while I was teaching the course, I said, there was a murder in the book that we were talking about. And I said, does this seem like the murderer would really, you know, feel this way? And there was a silence in the room and nobody said anything. And then finally, one guy raised his hand and he said, you know, some of us have killed people and some of us haven't. But speaking as one who has, I would say it does seem realistic to me.
Oh, my goodness. How scary.
That's fantastic.
Because I was kind of thinking you've got that nice, friendly, curly headed Ted Bundy look. but thanks for being here today. What drew you to the lonely life of spending so much time with your fingers on a keyboard? You know, writers, I think, could technically be diagnosed with objectophilia, you know, where we're in love with keyboards. And, of course, in this age of smartphones, most everyone could have objectophilia. But what led you to decide you're going to spend so much time just you and a keyboard and a computer screen?
Well, I started writing when I was in first grade, and I wrote poems about how my baseball team, the Baltimore Orioles, was going to defeat the hated Yankees. And I really enjoyed doing it, and I decided I would become a writer. Somehow I knew that I needed more life experience. So I didn't really start writing more things until I was in 10th grade, when I got a crush on my drama teacher, a woman named Karen Kramer. And she suggested I write a play, and I did. And the play was done at the local Women's Methodist club at the church. And I really enjoyed it and seeing my words acted out. And then when I was 18 years old, I got I got sick. I got an illness that wasn't diagnosed. And I told myself that if I ever got healthy again, that I would remember that what was central to my life was writing. And I did get healthy again after about 3 months. And ever since then, I've stuck to writing consistently, except for a brief period where my career wasn't going well and I applied to law school. But then as soon as I got in, things started breaking tremendously for my career. So that got rid of that idea. So I've just been dedicated to it really ever since I was 18 years old. And to answer your question as to why, I don't actually know why. I can tell you a theory that I have, which is that I think people that don't communicate well often become writers. People that don't communicate well with other people in other kind of ways become writers as a different way to communicate. But I don't know if that theory is true, but I sort of have that theory about myself, and that's sort of...
That's really interesting. I kind of see writing as a grand action of creation. And do you find yourself being very driven to just produce words, and literally you're creating universes when you're writing?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the creation and being driven, it's very interesting. I have a friend who's an atheist who has been writing for 50 years, and he's now in his 70s, and he's just driven to keep writing book after book. He writes nonfiction. He's very successful. And it's so interesting that he's creating this legacy for himself. And he even likes to pile his books up and see how many he's written. And, you know, why does he do it? It's like, it's not that he thinks it's part of some grand scheme in a certain kind of way, but he just feels driven to do it. And I guess I would say that if I go through a couple of days where I haven't written, my wife is definitely wanting me to write again, because I just get cranky and a little harder to live with. And I don't know why it is, you know, I don't know why it is, but it's just, if I don't write on a day, then I just I don't feel that comfortable. And if I don't write for 2 days, I feel less, and 3 days, I feel less. I don't know why I'm driven that way. Maybe it's just garden variety workaholism. And if I was a lawyer or some other field, I would just work just as hard in that field. So all the kinds of issues that workaholics face, or if it's just that, I don't know, I just love doing it. It's like a puzzle. You get up in the morning, and depending what stage you're at, say you're writing an outline for something. It's like a puzzle. How am I going to get all the plot strands working, and at the same time, make sure that I have enough of the character stuff in there, so we really love the characters. And then if you're writing the actual a book or a teleplay or whatever, and you're writing the actual dialogue, you know, it's a puzzle to think, you know, first of all, how would these people actually speak? And then second of all, you know, what's the structure of the conversation? Because, you know, you don't want to like write circularly and just repeat the same thing in the conversation twice. So it's an interesting blend of just being very intuitive about how people speak. I don't know if intuitive is the right word, but being very in touch in a way with how people speak, and also being very, what's the word, left brain, where you're really thinking about the structure of the thing. So you really have to get like all the different parts of your mind kind of working together to write something, you know, that is satisfying.
Well, my neuropsych professor up in New York would say that the left side is important, and the right side is kind of like the assembly plant, and starts assembling things and putting all these thoughts together. And it really is a bit of an act of creation. But do you think it's for you, it sounds like it's very, to use a Freudian term, very cathartic, that to get that all out there. As humans, we deepen relationships by communication, but it strikes me as just an amateur, and I mean really amateur writer, that when you're writing, you're really having conversations with, well, universes of people. You've got a whole crowd of people that you have to have a conversation with that is realistic.
Yes, and you have to keep your audience in mind and make sure you're going to, you know, give your book or your teleplay something that is going to move fast and people will enjoy it. I would say it is cathartic. You know, when I think back to, you know, I've written six novels. They've all been murder mysteries or thrillers. And, you know, in one murder mystery, I killed off an elementary school principal. And, you know, our kids were going to elementary school, and I was just ticked off at the principal. You know, I killed him off.
That sounds very cathartic.
Very cathartic. Another novel, we lived next door to some drug dealers, and even more annoying, the drug dealers rented that house from a cop. And it's like, really? So yeah, I wrote a novel where, you know, I killed off the cop. My novel that's coming out on January 17, the thriller called Killer Story. You know, in that novel, I explore a lot of different things, but one is how you feel when you've been laid off. So the hero of this book is a journalist, an idealistic journalist, who, you know, journalists are getting laid off all the time now. I read the other day that two newspapers go under in the United States every single week. I mean, I had to reread that a couple times to make sure I was reading it accurately. So newspapers are going under, journalists are losing their jobs. So I created a main character named Petra. She gets laid off from one newspaper job, no fault of her own. Then she gets laid off from another newspaper job, no fault of her own. She gets laid off from another newspaper job. And now she's about to get laid off from her fourth one. And it's just wreaking havoc with, you know, her self-esteem, because even if you know it's not your fault, your mind gets screwy. And it's wreaking havoc on her relationship with her fiance. And one reason that I wrote this, there are a variety of reasons, but one is, you know, having written in TV for the past 20 years, every TV writer has the experience at some time of being laid off. And for me, I've had the experience, I think actually also four times. And, you know, sometimes it's just something like there's a new head writer on the TV show and they want to bring in their own people. So sometimes it's, you know, through no fault or whatever of your own, but it's just very stressful getting laid off. So I think this book was, there were a lot of motivations for me in writing the book, but in terms of, I think your question was about catharsis. In terms of it being a cathartic experience for me, I would say to, you know, put all my feelings and thoughts and drive in the person of the main character of this book, Petra.
That's amazing. At the end of, and we'll come back to some more specifics, but at the end of writing one of these novels, is your experience one of, joy that is complete? Are you exhausted? Is it, holy crap, I'm glad that's over, I'm never doing that again? What's your experience on putting that final period on the final page, on the final sentence?
Well, in terms of exhilaration, I don't totally feel exhilarated until I've sold it.
Of course.
But in terms of when I finish it, I have a variety of feelings. You know, sometimes I feel like, holy tomato juice, this is freaking great. Oh my God, this is just fabulous. Look at this. I really think I got it across. Look at this. It's really original. It's really different. It's really exciting. Oh my God, this is great. And then sometimes I'll have this feeling like, I kind of feel that, but like, I'll feel like, oh my God, I hope I got it right on, you know, this one aspect of the book. You know, I hope I can get really obsessive. I hope page 40, you know, isn't too expositional. You know, I'll get it in my head that the whole book will be bad because I'm worried about exposition on page 40. So I can go all kinds of different feelings, exhilaration, obsession with some small thing. But once I have a book that I really, really feel good about, I mean, it is a great feeling because you've spent anywhere from 6 months to a year, you know, writing this, and you're not really sure if, you know, it's going to be good or, because you just don't know. I mean, I've written some stuff that I thought was no good, was junk, and turned out to be good. And I've written, people really responded to it. And I've written some stuff that, you know, I give people and they say, oh man, this needs a lot of work. You know, you really need to rewrite this. So you don't really know until you, you know, put it out there. But when you really get the word that people are really responding and enjoying your work, it is such a good feeling. I don't know how to describe it. You definitely feel very connected. Well, I'll say one experience I've had is that, you know, I've written for TV a lot. I wrote for Law and Order. And I remember when I started, and other shows, but even throughout, I would sometimes, the show would air Wednesday, 10 p.m., I would sit in my living room and I'd say to myself, and I'd watch the show with my mother-in-law, my wife, maybe three other people. And I would sit there and I'd think, wow, you know, 10 million other people are watching my words right now. You know, oh my God, you know, that is such a trip. And I remember after watching the show, I'd go up on my porch and sit by myself and say to myself, wow, 10 million people just watched my words. And then you get another kind of feeling when you write a stage play, which I've done, which is, you know, you see the theater full of people and everybody's kind of experiencing kind of some of the same things at once. And it creates this feeling of community. You know, there's just this community of people there. And you see or hear everybody laughing at once, or you sense everybody being moved at once. And that's a really special feeling. And then when I write a book, I like to think about how I read. When I read a novel, it's my favorite form of entertainment is to read a thriller. When I read a novel, you know, I lie on the sofa, I have tea near me, and I just read, and I just really, that's it. So when I write a novel, and when it, you know, when it's, especially after it's published, I just imagine the people out there who are sitting in their rocking chair or lying on the sofa and, you know, sipping some tea and just having this private experience, the same kind of experience I have, you know, when I write and when I read, I mean, and that's kind of special too. So, you know, I don't know why I like it so much in a way, you know, the most important thing is just that you know, you get along with your family and your close friends and you're good to them. And who cares what 10 million people think of my Law and Order episode or what they get out of it. The most important thing, you know, obviously is that I treat my kids well, is that we get along, that my wife and I have a good relationship. You know, that's most important. The part of it that's about fame, which is true for all writers, I think, or all before, is a little bit screwy, I think. The part of it that is about communicating to other people, I like that part of it. I like knowing that people are thinking about something that was really super important to me, and they're getting to know, in the case of my book Killer Story, they're getting to know my experiences better because I've had some of those. And they're also getting to know this character's experience, who I know she's fictional, but, you know, I came to love her, and I like it when other people love her too.
Now, I want to go back. You said the part about fame is screwy. What? Tell us more about that. What are you talking about when you say the part of fame is screwy?
Well, why should we really care if we're famous? In the sense that, you know, what's going to be our biggest legacy or our biggest importance in this world? You know, it's really going to be these you know, if you have kids, these kids that you raise, you know, if you whatever, if you're a therapist, the people that you've helped as a therapist, you know, whatever your job is, the people that are in your daily life, the people that you meet, the people that you see, you know, that's really the most, you know, important thing, you know, and really, you know, having, you know, millions of people watch your TV episode, it's going to have some little impact on them. It might make their lives a little better. It'll certainly entertain them for, you know, an hour, which is good. You know, it's good to entertain people. That's value. So, I mean, it's good. It's valuable. Here's what I think sometimes. I think sometimes that I have this much effect. Is my finger on the screen? I have a tiny little effect on people when they watch my TV episode, say. I have a somewhat bigger effect when people are watching like a stage play and they're sitting there, actually. I just think that's more impactful on people. And maybe something like that when I write a book, because if people read it, you're sitting by yourself, I feel like you're kind of impacted. I don't know, something like that. So you have that effect on a lot of people. But if you treat your family well or you treat the people in your life well, you have a huge impact. One person or two people or three people. So like, you know, like what's more important in life? To have a huge, huge positive impact on a few people, or to have a minor positive impact on many, 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 many people? Like if you added up all the good that you do in the world, each of those, who knows, you know, how it adds up. I don't know. This is all kind of theoretical that I'm speaking of, but it is something that I think about, because when I think about, you know, really trying to be famous, and I think about in context of politicians and just everybody, I think, you know, what's fame really about? I don't particularly believe in God myself, but I don't believe if there's a God and I go to to heaven and I'm sitting at the pearly gates or whatever, I don't think the first thing God is going to say is going to be, he's not going to be saying, or they're not going to be saying, you know, like, oh, you did a good job on Law and Order, dude. I think they're going to be saying like, okay, here's what I think about, how you were with, your family and your close friends and all the corny stuff, like, did you visit, your buddy when he was in the hospital? Did you remember to call, this person when he was sick? And, that's what God's going to be talking about mainly. Yeah.
Well, people die and fame fades. I really like what Jim Carrey said. I just kind of caught this on one of his social media posts about an interview. He said, no, I think everyone should be rich and famous so that they would understand that that's not what helps. That's not the purpose of anything.
Yeah, I think Jim Carrey is a pretty deep guy. I don't know him personally, but just from looking at some of the things he's drawn and some of the things he's said, I'm sure that's why you're interested in him as a guest. Some of the things he said, he does seem to take a really a very deep view of life and what he's doing.
Yeah, and I think would you agree that when you first made it big in writing, and maybe a 10 million people were watching your work on TV, it might have made a big impact, but that impact fades over time?
Yeah, I think so. If you think about like what works of art, you've really thought about over the years and have stuck with you. I could probably name about, 10 or 20 or maybe 30 that have really had an impact on me in my life. I've really thought about seeing the musical The Fantastics when I was 6 years old, seeing Pirates of Penzance when I was 9 years old, having my dad read me Winnie the Pooh, when I was a kid. I could name some things. But yeah, most of the stuff that you see is not going to really have that much of an impact. We're watching White Lotus now, which I find interesting. Uh-huh. I think it does kind of crystallize a certain kind of view of humanity. So that could stick with me for like 6 months or a year. I don't know. But I don't know. Yeah, mostly things it's fine. You entertain people. It's good. People watch my Law and Order episode. They have a good hour, I have to accept that that's a positive. If you entertain people for an hour, that's great.
Well, I my mind goes back to Marcus Aurelius, who talked about when he got up in the morning, it's his job to do the work of a human. And I think that we should be doing the most good for people that we possibly can. But the human brain cannot conceive of 10 million people. We just can't. But I think of those one or two people that got something out of a specific scene or a specific line that you put in a character's mouth that really helped them think in a different way, that let them see that there's hope in their life, even that helped them laugh, and they've not laughed for a long time, that those one or two people that episode really stuck out to, I think that you make a huge difference if you can just reach one or two people with your writing.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I'll tell you that my writing that I'm most proud of, I'm just going to move the camera just for a second, so you can see my poster on the wall here.
Oh, so cool. I love that.
So it's the title of it is Sacred Journey. So I'm trying to move I'm probably not doing a great job. But anyway, it's a poster of a play I wrote called Sacred Journey. And that one was an amazing project because I met this guy who was a homeless guy living on the streets of Brooklyn. And I got to know him. And after I got to know him for a few months, I said, you've got a great story. Could I interview you? And he said, sure. And I said, because I'm interested in doing a one-man play, about you. So I took him to see a show off Broadway starring Cleavon Little called All God's Dangers, a one-man show. So he would know what I was talking about, what I wanted to do. And he said, oh, that's cool. I'd like that. So I interviewed him. And the play wound up getting produced all over the world. And in particular, it was performed by one actor named Adan Sanchez. And he performed it for about 4 years. And then he died of a brain aneurysm. And at his memorial service, it turned out that had been like the most, profound experience of his professional life by far. He was a Native American actor. And especially in those days, Native American actors did not get good roles. but this was a great role. And he got it. And it was like, you know, the culmination for him of his like acting experience, everything he put in. And it was a beautiful thing for him. So meeting this guy in Brooklyn, wound up to have a tremendous impact on this guy from Albuquerque. Meanwhile, the real life guy, when we brought the show to New York, you know, he came to the show every single night for the 10-week run of the show. And it was just very powerful for him to see his life up on stage. And I think it gave him a kind of a validation or something, meaning, gave him a meaning to his life that was great for him. Yeah, you never know what's going to happen when you write something. And, I think there are all kinds of endeavors, you know, that we do in life that we're helping people, you know, in ways that we don't know. I had a guy tell me something 30 years ago, and it stuck with me to this day. It's something I just remember to this day, and it's something I think about a lot. I don't even remember the guy's name. I remember a little bit what he looked like. He was a tall guy with dark hair and kind of a rectangular face. But like, you know, we just never know the impact that we're going to have on people. I had a guy from a bookstore say to me, "I'm still thinking about what you said 15 years ago when you came to the bookstore."
Oh, wow.
I don't remember what I said, to tell you the truth. But like, so we just have impacts on people, whether we're writers or not, that we can never really know, you know?
I think that you're guaranteed to have an impact if you pour your life into carrying out your purpose, and it sounds like you found your purpose. And for all your listeners, you can find your purpose out there also. And we're going to get down to the purpose of this episode more than some of the philosophical stuff, which I love that we talked about. But some of you guys tuned in to hear about murder, mayhem, and psychopathy. And coming up next, we'll talk about some of that. Let me ask you this question. What is it, Matt, that after all this inspirational writing that you've done and that led you to want to write about murder and psychopaths?
That's a good question, and it's one to which I don't know the answer. But I will say that my favorite reading has always been reading murder mysteries and thrillers. And when I was younger, it was murder mysteries, and now it's thrillers, which often involve murders. And I think it's a good idea to write what you love, you know, to write something you would really love, you know, reading. So that's one answer I would give. But as to why I really like them, you know, I'm not sure. I can give you some answers, but I don't know if they're true or not. One thing that standardly about murder mysteries is that they're very satisfying because you take people through the darkest kind of thing where somebody freaking kills somebody. It doesn't get any darker than that. And then you solve it. You find a resolution. It has a happy ending. You know, we get justice and we restore order in the world. So we have a chaotic world and we restore order. So that's probably somewhere in there for me. That's kind of the standard thing that people say. I also find when I read books that don't have a murder in them, I don't know, I just get a little bored sometimes. It's like,
it's not exciting till a body drops.
Yeah, because that like has huge stakes, you know, because that's like, oh my God, we got to find who did it and get justice and keep this person from killing again, especially if it's a thriller. That's how they work. And so then, you know, it's just like automatic high stakes. Like sometimes I'll be reading a short story in The New Yorker, and I'm like, I don't give a hoot. You know, it's just like people sitting around in the dining room talking or something. You know, so, you know, I think it has high stakes for me. And then why else do I like it? This is another standard kind of answer that people give, which is probably true of me, is that, you know, we're just fascinated by our darker natures. You know, all of us could, you asked me at the beginning if I had killed. All of us, you know, I think have the ability under, you know, certain circumstances to kill somebody. And I think we're all interested in that impulse inside ourselves, which we keep squelched. We have a lot of other things going on, so squelch might not be the right word. But you know, this part of ourselves, it's pretty dark. We like to see other people act it out. And then we like to see the good part of ourselves, you know, the hero, you know, who's able to solve the crime and prevent, you know, horrible things from happening.
Well, I think I often say that the brain creates thoughts the way blizzards create snowflakes, and I think that probably 98% of the population has had the thought of somebody they want to kill. Of course, they would never do it, and they may not even want to admit that, but we can imagine all kinds of things, and I think that probably you have to be very good at imagining it if you're going to put it on a page that gets read by people. But what do you think it is that makes you different than other murder mystery writers?
For full show notes and transcript of today's episode, go to therapybites.podbean.com.
The Therapy Bites podcast is HIPAA compliant. No identifying patient information will be disclosed by Therapy Bites podcast hosts or Therapy Bites podcast guests without permission from patients or guardians. All personal stories are de-identified in order to comply with HIPAA, the NASW Code of Ethics, and the ethical principles of psychologists and code of conduct. Fresh from the therapy couch and from the deep dark recesses, stories may involve exploding preconceived notions and topics uncomfortable to underthinkers and small farm animals. Audience discretion and duct taping your head for safety is advised. Concrete-headed Kool-Aid drinking humans assume all risks associated with any possibility of choking to death on the accurate, realistic thoughts presented in the art lab. This is natural selection, and Therapy Bites podcast management and hosts are not responsible.
Hey guys, Doc Heath here for another segment on Fresh from the Therapy Couch, where we share with you real life stories of healing, hurts, hang-ups, and habits fresh from the therapy couch. Let's talk about the first session of marriage therapy, boxing ring. I've made the mistake plenty of times early in my career, beginning with session number one being a joint session. And inevitably, one or more of the following happens. Jockeying for alliance with the clinician, both sides of the couple playing the blame game, battles over perspective as if one version is the actual gospel truth, people thinking the clinician is taking sides, and that's probably one of the most popular, people actually blaming the clinician for not doing something right. And if they're starting off the bat, session number one, with both of you in the room, you're not altogether wrong with that in blaming the clinician, because that's not the best idea. Screaming matches to see who can achieve the highest decibel level, people walking out, and then people refusing to return. Listen, if you're seeking relationship counseling and your chosen clinician is either not well trained enough or insightful enough to know that a joint session right off the bat isn't a great idea, then you recommend a one-on-one session for each of you and do it yourself. Don't wait on the clinician to do it. For things to turn out well in marriage therapy, relationship therapy, they need to start out well, and that's with a separate one-on-one session, and that's Doc Heath on Fresh from the Therapy Couch.
You're listening to Therapy Bites Art Lab, bite-sized therapy for your brain with Dr. Heath and the T-Ball Team. The best advice on the net. No copay required.
Welcome to the Therapy Bites Art Lab Library, where we have pored over thousands of volumes to bring you the latest Couch Crumbs quote. Oh, would you like a napkin? You're getting crumbs in the book.
That okay, me eat book.
Oh. And now today's Couch Crumbs quote.
Good evening. If your first instinct is to cut your losses, you'll miss out on most of the gains in life. A quote by Doc. Oh, look, we are getting so many crumbs on the couch.
Oh, you got crumbs on the couch. Extra points for you!
Live the art life. Become a T-Ball teammate, inner circle supporter on Patreon at patreon.com/therapybites.
Here's Heath and the T-Ball Team.
For this show, before we got onto the show, I was thinking, how many people have killed? Not necessarily committed murder, like that it's a crime, but how many people have killed? So I was wondering. So I actually got on the internet and I asked, what percentage of people have killed somebody? Or what percentage of people in the United States have killed somebody? Or how many people? And like, I couldn't get an answer. I mean, I looked and I looked, because you add up, let's say, accidental crime. You know, you just, God forbid, you get in an accident, you hurt somebody, actual murder, or maybe being in a war and killing somebody.
Yep.
Or maybe you kill somebody in self-defense and you wouldn't really call that a murder. That's not what I would call a murder. So all the different ways in which you might, you know, God forbid, kill somebody. And how, you know, what percentage of people? I'm sorry to say I don't know the answer to that question, because I really looked it up for about 20 minutes before we got on today. I was just curious about it. Anyway, what was your question?
Well, I want to ask that again, but since you said that, something came to my mind. I've actually been involved in therapy with a good number of people who've killed people.
Yeah.
And it strikes me that the psychology is very different from each one of them. Probably the most frequent are soldiers who kill people in battle. One soldier, and actually I've had several soldiers share this, that they went to war, never wanted to kill someone, and then it became inevitable. It was a choice between pointing the rifle and pulling the trigger and maybe saving their whole battalion from a bomb, or not pulling the trigger because they don't know if the person's really a threat or not. And one of those threats was of a guy that was running toward a convoy, and the soldier pulled the trigger, and of course he killed the national, the resident of the country. And found out later he was running to the convoy because he heard the convoy had water. Now, the psychology and the psychological fallout of that was a much different than other types of killings. For instance, I've had folks who kill people in auto accidents. I've had parents who have, through an accident, killed one of their children. I've done therapy with a serial killer that said, if you want to kill somebody, the best thing to do is feed them to the alligators in Florida, because no body, no crime. And it dawns on me that the psychology of every death is quite different. How much time do you spend developing the psychology behind your killers?
A lot of time. I will go for walks on my own and think about it, or I'll go for a bike ride and think about it, or I'll go swimming and think about it. And sometimes I will also go for long walks with my wife, and we'll just talk about it. And we'll, with the killers and the other characters in the book, we'll treat it as like we're gossiping about them. Like, instead of talking about the neighbors or, you know, friends or employees, coworkers, we'll just gossip about the characters in the book, and we'll just say all kinds of things. If it's the killer, you know, what does the killer like to wear on the day that he kills? That's something that always got me. It was like, that was Elmore Leonard's big thing. He liked to write the killer in the morning on his way to the murder, deciding what clothes to wear. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. So I always think about that. And,
well, you know, dress for success.
I guess so. I wear black myself. I don't know. Which I'm wearing right now, of course, but I'd like to know what kind of music they like to listen to, you know, and what their parents were like and their family and everything about them, you know, what they want, what they like to eat for breakfast, you know, they eat oatmeal or what, bacon or what. So, I spent a lot of time thinking about them. You know, the better scaffolding you have for the characters, you know, for sure, the better.
I wonder if killers have a particular or typical diet. You know, Dexter, I was fascinated by the psychology behind, they did the whole intro scene there. Dexter was always eating meat and cutting meat and biting meat. It was all very kind of a violent thing, even with his eating habits at the first of the show. Of course, Dexter being the famous fictional serial killer. Do you find that people have, your killers have these special quirks of what they eat, and that works very well for you?
I mean, that's a really good question. I really wonder if serial killers have unhealthy diets. You know, that would be like my bias, you know, because it seems like such an unhealthy lifestyle to be a serial killer. So I would think that they would, you know, probably do a fair amount of drugs and alcohol and sugar and not eat particularly well.
Well, evidently Jeffrey Dahmer, his favorite food was people.
Well, okay, I guess that's.
But you make a good point. You know, my research is in psychopathy. I did my doctoral research in psychopathy, and it's a bit of a impulse control disorder in a very specific area. And I found that people higher in psychopathy, the difference in their brain. Well, the research was, I showed a sample of participants these pictures from what's called the International Affective Picture Set, IAPS, and some were pictures of kittens, and some were pictures of children and sunsets, but then some were very disturbing pictures, you know, mutilated bodies and mutilated animals and very, you know, war, very disturbing pictures. The amazing thing is that for people who were lower on the psychopathy scale, there was more differences in activation. In other words, literally, I could measure changes in blood flow that were drastic between a picture of a baby and a picture of a mutilated animal. There's a big shift, big activation. With people higher in psychopathy, there was no real statistically different activation.
So a baby looked like the same thing to them as a mutilated body?
Well, I don't know I would say it looked like the same thing. It just, their brains recognized, there just wasn't a different level of activation. Nothing lit their brain up. It was all just a hum, just a steady hum. One of my favorite serial killers is Richard Kuklinski, that after he was interviewed and they found out he'd killed probably 300 people, and he would take them into his basement and he would cut their bodies apart. He would wrap up their different body parts and put it in the freezer, because that was one of his methods. If you confuse the police on when as to date of death, it makes you harder to catch, because then you have a better alibi. They can't pin you down and all that. But an interviewer asked him, you know, did you never get upset? You're in your basement cutting up bodies. Did that never affect you adversely? And he thought for a moment and he said very deliberately, well, if I got blood on a really expensive pair of shoes, that would really tick me off. He tells another story of seeing a guy outside of a bar urinating in public. And of course, he followed the guy to his car, doused him in a flammable liquid and burned him to death. He said, you know, I didn't think a person could live that long. He said, I heard the guy screaming. I was blocks away. I could still hear the guy screaming. And they asked him about it, and he was a bit surprised at the question, because he said, well, you just don't do that. You just don't urinate in public. It's rude. It made perfect sense to him that you would burn someone to death. And my research showed it's just a very different brain of a psychopath, all of which, of course, aren't serial killers. To be a serial killer, you have to be a psychopath, but you can be a psychopath without being a killer at all. As a matter of fact, one of my psychology preceptors told me on my first visit with him, he knew about my research, he said, I just want to tell you, I'm a psychopath. I thought he was joking, and he wasn't. He's a practicing psychologist and a self-admitted psychopath. And he didn't kill anybody. He just had a different way of looking at the world.
And what's the definition of a psychopath?
There's really four factors, and they mesh together. And one of those is antisocial behavior. And then there's affect. And that's the thing that my research got into, that there's a whole constellation. By the way, guys, I'll drop this in the show notes with a link, and you can click on it and you can see the graphic. But it's really a constellation of things that fit together that equal psychopathy. And the interesting thing that my research showed is you really can't pick out a psychopath based on looks. For all you know, your Sunday school teacher is a psychopath. Or I don't like labeling as a psychopath as much as I talk about a continuum of psychopathy. And I think this may shock some folks and I may get some nasty letters, but we're all on the continuum, but most of us are way low, way, way low. And some are closer to the midpoint, but you really may not even notice the psychopathy in a person until you get beyond the midpoint and things just kind of start to stick out. Well, another of my theories that I didn't have the equipment to test, because what I used was near-infrared spectroscopy and a device called a hemoencephalograph that measured frontal lobe or cortical blood flow in the brain, shot a beam of light to your eye and gave a read back as to how much blood flow was in that particular area. But my theory is that when I'm looking at Matt and when Matt's looking at me, if I were to take a fork and gouge out my eyeball and then start to eat my eyeball, see, if you guys should watch this on the YouTube channel, because Matt automatically, his face grimaced. Now, that grimace is the result of his mirror neuron system. Not because he likes me. Matt just met me. We've communicated by chat.
I like you.
But he's just met me. But Matt actually just built a model, a golem, a clay figure in his brain, so to speak, of me, and is projecting onto that as if the eyeball being gouged out with a fork and eaten is happening to him. Now, that's the result of mirror neurons replicating my experience in his brain. Now, with psychopaths, particularly those that are serial killers, that effect does not take place. They may say, hey, cool, do the other one next, because they just find it interesting. But they have no way of mimicking in their brain the experience of another person. Now, for some people, this really works big time. With TV shows. My wife, who I love, we watch Blue Bloods. We may watch Law and Order and try to catch some of your writing next. But she routinely tells me to turn off a show if it's too graphic or another human is being harmed because of the proliferation of mirror neurons that psychopaths don't have. And for her, that also extends to four-legged critters. And that doesn't work for everybody. See, if you're a little bit higher on the psychopathy scale than my wife is, then you may not be very affected by the suffering of animals. I'm pretty high, she's pretty high, pretty low on the psychopathy scale. So our level of activation of mirror neurons when we see the suffering of an animal, a dog, cat, even a squirrel. The other day I had a patient and we were sitting on the front porch and there was a praying mantis that was having trouble, and I noticed the praying mantis had lost a leg and I rescued it. I just, you know, it's mirror neuron system and what I'm telling myself about the mantis. But effect...
Going back a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
I'm interested that, like, the idea that, like, if a serial killer or someone high on the psychopathic scale, if they see a picture of a baby, they say feel the same way as if they see a picture of a mutilated body. And so I get the absence of affect and that you know, it has an impact. But I guess the other thing I always thought is that that type of individual really, really enjoys, you know, gets pleasure out of seeing mutilated body. So I'm wondering, is there like brain imaging or whatever that shows, you know, that they have the joy that they get out of it? Because I imagine Jeffrey Dahmer really, really enjoyed what he was doing.
Well, that's a really great question. The answer is yes. And I'll try to drop some research again in the show notes so you guys that are nerdy like I am can look that up. But what Matt's talking about, I'll explain it this way. Whatever you give your brain to do, your brain doesn't really judge it. It just doesn't. It doesn't matter if it's healthy or unhealthy, moral, not. It really your brain really doesn't care, especially if you keep on doing it. You can give your brain anything to do, and the more you do it, the more brain cells it will give birth to. Literally, it's called neurogenesis, literally give birth to. And then if you keep doing it long enough, those brain cells will connect to other brain cells, forming intersections and circuits. That's called synaptogenesis. And all of a sudden, you'll actually have a lot of cortical real estate taken up. It could be eating feces out of the toilet. It doesn't matter. And what does the brain enjoy doing? The brain literally gains pleasure from lighting up circuitry already existing. It doesn't get pleasure typically out of forming new circuitry because that's so hard. I mean, what if I were to say, hey, I want you to learn how to stand on your head and shoot a basketball. Well, who would want to do that? Somebody might take me up on it, but it would not automatically usually be a pleasurable experience. But let's just take psychopaths when they're younger. They may experiment out of curiosity. What happens when I strap a frog to a bottle rocket or something? But they start out because they're curious. But then that curiosity, if it's done often enough, leads to pleasure. Now, why is there pleasure? There's pleasure in repeating what your brain knows. There's pleasure in igniting circuitry that already exists. And so what Jeffrey Dahmer, Ted Bundy, all they're doing is just following a routine. My puppy dog, he has a routine. His routine is 7 o'clock every night is bedtime. And he insists that we all be in the doghouse. By the way, the doghouse is our master bedroom. And he has such a routine that he will keep coming to get us in the living room until we give in and follow him to his doghouse, the master bedroom. Now, he gets pleasure out of that because it's just repetition of a circuit. And what a serial killer is doing is they're simply repeating a circuit over and over and over again. Someone that uses a drug, I teach in addiction work with people, that it's not the drug, it's the reigniting of that circuitry that has been designed to light up in the presence of that drug. Hopefully that makes some sense, and you guys can send me emails and letters and questions, and I'll be able to explain it further. I don't want to nerd out too much.
It definitely makes sense. I still feel like I would like to know, like, why, you know, I just feel like why Jeffrey Dahmer, Ted Bundy hit that circuit, you know, in the first place. Like, I understand the pleasure of repeating it, but like why they were driven to do that in the first place, what it was. I'm sure with each of them, it's individual. And I'm also just wondering what the brain shows that would like when they kill somebody, is it like the pleasure I get when I eat an apple? You know, does, you know, the same part of my brain light up when I eat an apple that they get when they're, you know, killing somebody? So
yeah. And I think that's a fabulous question. You know, we've been studying psychopathy, in earnest, I think since World War I, and Cleckley is the famous book that he wrote, The Mask of Sanity, where he first began to notice that people really do wear a mask and look normal, and they're really wolves in sheep's clothing, but that's part of their gig. Ted Bundy, for instance, he was famous for putting a cast on his arm. Why? Well, because a person that has an injury doesn't appear to be threatening, and your mirror neurons take over. And you see a guy in a cast and you want to help him out, and plenty of women helped him out and then helped themselves to their deaths by falling for this mask of sanity. That's, you know, it really is. There's a book called The Psychopath Next Door. There's really no way to pick a psychopath or a serial killer out of a crowd.
So do you believe what I've read, that that there's a high percentage of business CEOs that are psychopaths?
Well, you know, that's an interesting thing. There is some research there that the top professions that are filled with people higher on the psychopath scale are Wall Street bankers and politicians, and guess what? Surgeons. Now, why surgeons? Surgeons because it's just the perfect cover for the exercise of psychopathy, because you can legally cut bodies apart, people volunteer for it, and they even give you money to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the perfect storm. That'd be a good book, The Psychopath Surgeon or something, you know.
But that would be.
It's really a different kind of animal, a different kind of creature. Humans are in the animal kingdom. People high on the psychopathy scale, it's its own special kind of animal. I wanted to go back to, I was fascinated that you and your wife actually collaborate on this.
Yeah, we do. We do. It's, you know, writing can be a lonely business. So it's really fun to collaborate with somebody. And yeah, we'll take long walks and we'll talk about the characters. And especially she's very useful to me with women characters. She has insights that I don't necessarily immediately have. It's a great way to, it's a great relationship thing for us.
Hey, what about this storyline? What about the storyline of a murderer who takes long walks with his wife and collaborates about murder, and he really carries him out? She just doesn't know about it. it's his own little secret life. The question I want to come back to is, what makes you different as a writer in this particular murder mystery genre? What sets you apart?
I think that I'll talk about my novels, maybe my TV shows too, but certainly my novels. I think I'm really good at plotting. I think my books are real page turners. I think I probably learned that to a large extent from working in TV, and actually plays too, stage plays, because on TV and in plays, you can't skim. You're like, you're stuck there watching it. You know, you're stuck there watching the play. You're sitting in the theater, or if you're watching TV, you know, you can't exactly like wander off for a minute and then come back. So I learned that every single second is precious. And so I think my novels are good page turners, because I've been educated into that. I've trained myself into that. It's like, I don't want anybody skimming my book, even for a paragraph. So I'll read a fair number of books that I might even enjoy. I might give them good reviews, you know, on Goodreads, and I might recommend them to people. And yet I'll know that I skimmed maybe 50 pages of that book. I like The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown, but out of that 650-page book, I probably skimmed a good 250 or 300 pages.
Oh, wow.
That's what I did. So I think people don't skim my books very much. I think they're really tightly constructed and tightly plotted. I would say that for one thing. And then I think just, you know, every writer is different. We have different concerns. I have a book came out last year called The Necklace. And The Necklace is about a middle-aged diner waitress from a small town in upstate New York who travels to North Dakota to witness the execution of the man who was convicted of killing her young daughter 20 years previously. And during the course of her trip, she starts to realize maybe the guy is actually innocent. Maybe he didn't do it. He's going to be executed Saturday at 5:30 p.m. Maybe he's innocent. Maybe the real killer is still out there. And maybe there's another girl who might be in danger right now. So, I mean, it's a good plot. It's a good story. And it's a great hero. And like this, I'm going to tell you what makes it different to me. There may be other things, but here's one thing that makes it different. I read a lot of thrillers, and usually they have a young protagonist. Usually it's a young woman protagonist. Usually it's in a big city, and they have some kind of glamorous job, some kind of exciting, you know, in the field of entertainment or music or fashion. You know, something that like has glamour attached to it. And part of the fun of the book for readers, including me, is to kind of imagine yourself in this world, is to see, you know, this glamorous world people are part of. And that's fun. If the book is set in a small town, then it tends to be kind of a she small town, a tourist town, you know, Bar Harbor, Maine, or just some place where, you know, there's nice bakeries and shops. So they're spelled S-H-O-P-P-E-S. But there's not many books at all, really at all, thrillers, not many at all, that have as a hero a woman who's in her 50s, a woman who is a diner waitress, who lives from paycheck to paycheck. And in researching this book, I was stunned to discover how many Americans live paycheck to paycheck. I remember the number is 53% live paycheck to paycheck. I just did not know that. So anyway, even though so many do live paycheck to paycheck, you don't find them in thrillers, but you do in mine. So she's middle-aged. She's living in a small town that is not she. It's like, I'm trying to figure out the right way to say this, but it's the politics in the small town are not the politics one would find in a big city. And there's whatever, people are not, it's tough time economically for folks and for our hero in particular. And these folks are not represented in thrillers. So I had a really fun time writing about this person who I really liked a lot. And she's inspired by people that I know, because every summer for the last 30 years, we've lived in a small town in upstate New York that is, you know, not doing particularly well economically, but we have a house on a lake there and we love it there. And so I knew the people and nobody had written about them. I mean, he's not in thrillers. And so not in novels in general and not in thrillers. And so, so that was different. And I've gotten a lot of response from people that this is the kind of hero that we never see. So I don't know, each book that I write has its own thing. I don't know if there's a general overall thing that I would say is sort of different about me beyond that I think my plots are very strong and very page-turnery. And Killer Story, the one that I'm writing, my main character does some bad things. She's not always that great. She has some very complicated moral decisions to make. And I would say that's one thing that's characteristic of my books, is that people often have very difficult moral decisions to make, and that's what the book's about. And that's certainly true in this book. But there are other writers that do that too. You know, there's other writers that have like characters that really do some things that seem pretty bad, and that, you know, their behavior is pretty wrong sometimes. So I wouldn't say I'm unique in that, but in this book, that is one of the things that I do. I know in my Law and Order episodes, people would always say that they could always tell my episodes from others because they were funnier.
That's always helpful.
Yeah. So
killer
humor. I think there's always been maybe a little bit of a twist and a humorous comic twist in what I write, even the things that tend to be pretty dark, that kind of shows. So I think, I don't know, those are, I think, some of the things that are, I guess, unique to me.
Well, on your journey of writing about psychopaths and killers, what are some of the surprising things you've learned about that segment of people?
Well, that's a great question. What have I learned about that set of people? You know, each one is different. I guess I would say I have to take it one book at a time. In my current book, Killer Story, I won't give any spoilers, but I will say that the killer is not like, you know, a serial killer who just doesn't give a hoot. You know, the killer is someone that really does not want to kill, does not, you know, want to be that way. And it's a struggle for them that they have been trying to overcome. They have committed murder and done some other heinous acts, but it's a struggle that they're trying to overcome. Here's what I would say. Okay, if I have one belief about bad guys in general, and this would be killers, but it would also be bad guys in general. And I don't know how you feel about this with your study of psychopathy, but I think some people, and maybe this is the psychopaths you're talking about, are like, yeah, I'm bad and I don't give a hoot. You know, I'm just bad to the bone. That's just the way it is. I don't care. But I think most people really like to see themselves as, you know, good people. And if they committed murder, it's because, well, they had to, or, you know, she made me, but I really am a good person. Or, you know, I screwed up, but that's not going to happen again. That's not me. And I think most people, they see themselves as good people. They're the stars of their life. They're the stars of their world, and they see themselves as good people. And if not, then it's like, well, anybody else would do the same things. So I think the worst, you know, talk about politicians being psychopaths. I think a lot of the, worst dictators in history have probably thought, you know, I'm a good guy. This is just what has to be done. It creates law and order. And this is the way humans are. I mean, let's face it. We're going to have, hierarchies. Uh-huh. Might as well be me at the top. And this is, it just makes sense. So I guess that's the one thing I would say that I believe about, and I'd like to hear what you say about psychopaths.
Well, Marcus Aurelius spoke that no one gets up in the morning believing they're going to do evil or planning to do evil. Even Vladimir Putin, he gets up in the morning and he doesn't think he's an evil guy. People don't get out of bed thinking that they're evil people because they give themselves reasons and they carry out their behaviors to be faithful to those reasons. I think you make a great point. And we all have the wonderful ability to justify and normalize all our behaviors. It really takes a person of amazing insight to see that admit that we're doing something wrong. You know, Viktor Frankl, the famous Austrian psychiatrist, Jewish man, one of my favorite people in the world, who was in a Nazi concentration camp, and the Nazis killed his mom, his dad, his wife, purportedly his unborn child, and his sibling, talked about one of the more ruthless doctors in the concentration camp that was responsible for killing, I don't know, unknown hundreds, if not thousands of people. This doctor finally found himself in a Russian prison camp. And the surprising thing is became known as one of the kindest, gentlest, most helpful people in that prison camp. Hmm. And wound up saving lives and healing people as a prisoner. And Frankl will tell this story to indicate that no one is ever, even a serial killer, no one is ever 100% anything. Mm-hmm. You may be 2% serial killer and then 98% family man. This was Dennis Rader. Dennis Rader, right. The BTK killer, he went home to his wife and kids every night, and they loved him and thought he was the best thing since sliced bread, no pun intended. And then they found out that he was slicing people up on the side, you know. And so, no, you make a wonderful point there, Matt. Do you think that, I'm going to put you on the spot, and hopefully the police aren't listening. You police, you can turn this off. But do you think you know enough about murder you could actually do it yourself and get away with it?
No, I think I would just, you know, my conscience or whatever would get to me. You know, when I do have those crazy thoughts about it, I wonder, I'd like to kill this person. And sometimes I do think about it. And then I just... No, I would just not be able to keep a straight face for the cops. I was questioned by the cops once on a, not a murder, just something very minor. Something was stolen from some office next to mine, and I don't remember all the details. It was years ago. And I had not, you know, been involved in any way. And I just remember, I think it was at night at some office. Anyway, I just remember when the cops questioned me, I was just terrified. I hadn't done anything, but I was just terrified. So no, I would be terrible. Oh, then there was the other time they questioned me. I was maybe 16, 17, and I had just bought pot for the first time, I think. And we were I grew up in Cincinnati, and we were in the backyard of our house, and we were really high, and we were looking up at the sky and imagining there were UFOs up there. And I had like a little bag of pot in my right pocket and a little pipe in my left pocket of my thin windbreaker, very thin windbreaker, very thin. And these cops came around the sides of my house. We were in my backyard, But the neighbors had called because I think we were looking up at the sky to see if we could find a UFO, and some neighbor thought we were looking in their upstairs window. So these cops came around, and I think they had a loudspeaker, and they said, you know, we're coming behind the house or whatever. And these two cops came, and I was so terrified, and I had this pot. And this was back when you could get into serious trouble for pot. This was a long time ago in Cincinnati. And I just remember, like, I just wanted, so I had a hand in the, like, in the pocket, the thin windbreaker, really thin, that had the pot in it, and a hand in the other pocket that had the pipe in it. And I wanted so badly to say, to just bring them out in my hands and say, here they are, here they are, here they are, just, you know. So it was terrifying.
You've got a confession mentality. I did it. Take me in now. Well, kind of closing out the episode here, a couple more questions I have here, then we'll let Matt go for the day, get back to his typewriter. Guys, this is for entertainment purposes only. Do not go out and try this at home. But what is your favorite secret getaway with murder hack?
Well, that's a great question. What's a great way to get away with murder? I like the idea of putting it in a swamp, feeding the body of the alligator. I guess I'd want to make it look like an accident so nobody would come after me, I would think.
There's a series of books from the 70s called The Destroyer, written by Richard Sapir and Warren Murphy. There's a movie made about it in 84 with Fred Ward called Remo Williams' Adventure Begins. And those guys wrote about the perfect accident. And that's what Remo and Chun, his guru, Yoda guy, trained him on, is make it look like the perfect accident. For you guys listening, I would say do what Matt does. If you want to get away with murder, write about it and leave it on the typewriter, leave it on the keyboard. And if you want to hear more from Matt, you can go to mattwittenwriter.com. That is MATTWITTEN writer.com, where you can learn more about him, his novels, TV episodes, get writing tips, and read a short story and a TV pilot for free. And one more thing we'll do that we surprise every guest with, I'll put it on the Artie cam, and I'm going to pull from the deep, dark recesses beneath the therapy couch here a special question curated just for Matt. And here it is. Matt, imagine someone encounters your psychopathic serial killer in one of your stories, maybe the story coming up, a killer story. What is the best way to survive that interaction?
Run.
Okay. Run faster than the killer, right? Okay. Well, thank you for joining us. It's been such a treat, and we look forward to the book. When's it coming out?
Book comes out. Let me show you a cover of the picture of the cover.
Oh, fantastic. You guys are listening, you'll have to go on the YouTube channel. Yeah, there's the cover.
Yep.
Killer story, Matt Witten. Wow, that is one big, thick book. How many pages did it wind up being?
How many is it? Let's see here. 350.
Well, that's not bad at all. That is not one fancy book, and you can get that on...
Yeah, it comes out January 17th.
That'll be on Amazon and all your favorite Village bookstores.
It will be, absolutely. It'll be everywhere, and it's also, for the very first week, it's going to be on sale on Kindle for only $2.99.
Wow.
Usually it's $15, but that first week, it's $2.99.
What a killer deal. Hey, thank you for joining us. Thank you, T-Ballers. Thank you for coming. And share it out to other folks that are interested in all this weird stuff about serial killer psychopathy and deep, dark stuff. Catch us on the next episode. Thanks, guys. Bye-bye now.
Welcome to On the Couch and Off Our Rocker with Dr. Ima Freudknot, where we review our special guest's Therapy Bites Art Lab episode, Psychomalarkey Scale Assessment Results. That's PMS for short.
Mr. Matt Witten's PMS performance places him in the 97th percentile on the PMS KDS Killer Devious Scale. This demonstrates a disturbingly low degree of fuzzy-wuzzy kitten content in Mr. Matt Witten's brain, and a constant tendency toward murder in his mind. Overall, the psychosillimetric results present a picture of an individual dreadfully disposed toward dreaming up dastardly deeds of death, but who tames darker designs by hammering out those murderous machinations on the keyboard, creating killer stories for the masses. This insidious soul likely has a very poor prognosis of producing fuzzy-wuzzy kitten content in the near future, until these deviously despicable darker features of his psyche have been psychomologically analyzed and exorcised. It is my considered opinion that Mr. Matt Vitton be prescribed production of no less than 500 to 1,000 words BID and another 1,000 PRN to curtail cadaverous cognitions. Dr. Ima Freudnot, Chief Shrinkstigator, Therapy Bites Art Lab.
Grab some of this episode's guest merchandise, specially designed to help keep this episode's message top of mind in your life. Don't forget friends and family members who could use an Art Lab mental boost too. Just go to therapybites.myshopify.com.
Hey, T-Ballers, thanks so much for being with us today. If we brought value to your day, show us some love by leaving your positive feedback and inviting some friends to listen in and join the T-Ball team. Next time on Therapy Bites Art Lab.
Hey, T-Ballers, welcome to another episode of Therapy Bites Art Lab, and that stands for Accurate Realistic Thinking, Life-Affirming Beliefs, where we help you biggie-size and biggin' supersize your life. And today we're going to be talking about the psychology of falling down, getting up, how to overcome those big hurdles and challenges in life. And it is our privilege to have a yoga teacher. We call it the professor of pretzelizing yourself. And that is Michael Harris. Join us coming up next.
Government legal gobbledygook. Therapy Bites is not intended as a diagnostic or as an alternative to professional clinical treatment. Resources and advice are for information and entertainment purposes only. Brought to you by someone saying things you don't like. Tape that nagging loudmouth shut. Government-approved speech tape. Gas tape. Now available at your local hardware store. Therapy Bites Art Lab is not an approved, endorsed, authorized, butt-kissing affiliate of the United States Special Offense Assessment Police. SOAP for short. Warning. Consumption of Therapy Bites Art Lab content by Kool-Aid drinking, stinking, thinking, social media, pseudo-psychological pushing, wacky woke, anti-free speech, mumbo-jumbo advocates may cause spontaneous internal skull combustion, stomach discomfort, and or laxative effects. Allergy warning. Therapy Bites is manufactured in a facility that challenges nutty distortions, processes nuggets of accurate, realistic thinking, and life-affirming beliefs. This is the audio version of the legal fine print. Why are you still listening to this when you can catch the next great episode of Therapy Bites Art Lab with a good friend or family member? Really? Are you still there? This is getting silly. Move on to the next psychologically thrilling episode of the best advice on the net. No copay required.
Me eat copay.
Yeah, with Dr. Heath and the T-Ball team. Go ahead. Don't be podgoraphobic. Scoot, scoot, scoot. On to the next episode.